Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello.
Welcome to Really with Tom and Dave. There. Ugh. I mean, you
We're
do
a little
all
chippy.
The, all the,
We're a little chippy do, today.
Do, well, I'm saying you. I mean, that's my one job. That's my one job.
No,
you do all the research and intros, and I just do the hello.
Oh,
that's it.
God, why do I want to do all the research and intro? I mean, we can change it up, man.
I don't want to. No. I like the way it is.
I like your lighting
distribution of work. Thank
I like
you.
Your lighting. How's it going over there? Lighting.
I'm trying to make my head not flare so much.
right.
With my fluorescent white hair.
The purple is working.
With my built-in bounce kit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no. Now you look completely like cool, mellow. You look like the bartender of Club Tattoo or some kind of, exotic locale.
Got some that'd be nice.
Drinks
well, there's
in the
a lot of booze behind me, so that's
I know.
Better,
I know. Making me thirsty. I'm a little behind the times, but I finished with Christina and I finished Fargo. And
you did?
And I'm going to join the chorus of saying, like, that was really good. It was really, really good. It was really, like, I mean,
great
we also
show.
Crushed the last episode. Like, we were, it hits a new rail. And so we were just jamming. It was really fun. It was very sad to see you go. I was really enjoying your performance.
There may be some people out there who haven't seen it yet.
No, I know. But we've already spoiled this ending multiple times on this podcast.
We? Okay, so, yes. Yeah. What you're referring to when my character packs his bindle on a stick and hobos it on a freight train out of town.
Hops on the train and is out, Mark Twain style.
Boxcar Willie plays.
Yes. But it was great. What a nice thing to be a part of. What great.
It's such a great show. Yeah. It's and
really
a great cast. Right. And,
now I have to catch up with other episodes, but it was a damn good cast.
And I made a real point of not reading the last script, the final script, because I didn't want to know how it ended. So I didn't know till I watched it. So that it was first there were surprises for me when we got. To
Where
the
did they
episode.
Find that monk guy? I mean, he was amazing.
He's fantastic, Steve Spruill from England. He's just a really great actor and a really lovely fellow. Not at all like his character.
I found it all thrilling, interesting, just fascinating, and loved the performances, but was then just very moved by that last episode. Just that last, just even that last 10 minutes.
It does something that you don't get often from Fargo. It is a positive, a life-affirming message about the value of decency and kindness.
I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, I think Noah Hawley, allowed real sentiment to come through.
It was really well done. Juno Temple is amazing. Yeah. John Hamm was great. Jennifer Jason Leigh was amazing. You were amazing. It was great. So good on you.
Thank you. It was
well
really
done.
Fun.
Took me a while, but I'm here to say everybody out there, get to Fargo season 5. In the meantime, we have a fascinating guest.
An informed and literate author on the subject.
Extraordinarily informed. Let me give you a little bit of the rundown on Mr. Graham Rendell, who is a full-time author and a commentator on the unidentified aerial phenomenon, the UAP subject. He's also a contributor to The Debrief, an American news website dealing with cutting-edge science, tech, and defense news, and a guest on various podcasts like this one dealing with the UAP. And he's a member of the UAP Media UK group advocating government transparency on the UAP issue. Graham has written a critically acclaimed work looking at the Foo Fighters witnessed during World War II and the numerous wartime cases that occurred before the term was coined in November 1944, as well as other books dealing with aerial UFO encounters between 1946 and 1954. He has been an aviation and World War II history enthusiast from an early age when he was given model aircraft kits to keep him quiet. Married to Joe, he lives in Upper Weardale, a quiet but picturesque part of County Durham, and we welcome him to Really.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Thanks for staying up so late. I apologize.
Oh, don't apologize, David. It's just part of the territory. There's lots of invitations from people on the West Coast, etc. So it's just one of those things you have to do, I'm afraid. So don't worry about it.
We're very sorry to keep you up so late, but yes, we're going to make it worth your while.
Yeah. How?
I'll hold you to that.
He just made a promise. I'm not sure we can really follow through.
Yeah, well, he's made the promise, Dave. You haven't, so yeah, you're absolved.
No, Dave's a part of this now. I rely on Dave for the fascinating part. We are actually thrilled to have you. I am neck deep in both UFOs Before Roswell, the European Foo Fighters book, which covers 1940 to 1945. As well as the 1950 and 1952 book, and I'm overwhelmed by the volume of the sightings. Just the how many? First of all, it's just beautifully documented. I mean, there's multiple witnesses in many cases dealing with pilots in their own words. In many cases, reminds me in some cases of Leslie Kane's book about which just dealing with were just credible witnesses, extraordinary encounters. Why were you drawn to this period? Like, what kind of compelled you to document? This is great for history. It was great for people interested in the topic. It's a great record that I don't know exists anywhere else. But what drew you to it?
Well, as you mentioned in the intro, I'm a long-standing aviation enthusiast. Apart from UFOs, I also have an interest in World War II, and all three things really go back, more than 40 years. So and you say that you're reading the UFOs Before Roswell, the Foo Fighters book, and that's the one I started with. And all those interests came together to write that book. And I felt it was a book that maybe needed to be written as well, because the previous sort of, works I've seen on the Foo Fighters, while some of them were really good, they didn't seem to have a huge amount of context in terms of what was happening around the sightings, and maybe explaining them in a bit more about the airplanes involved, and where they were and what they were doing and all this kind of stuff. So I felt that there was a bit more information that an audience could benefit from to tell the story. But there's also things like exploding the Nazi saucer myth. That's part of the book as well. And a lot of other things that have basically built up around the Foo Fighters that are now long-standing. If you tell something long and hard enough, it'll become a fact on the internet when it's nothing of the sort. So I felt those things needed to be explored as well. But then just moving on from that, because a lot of those cases were aerial cases, so, people flying in fighters or bombers, etc., who were meeting these strange objects, then I felt that could just continue that story on and tell the story of aerial encounters, but in bite-sized chunks. So the first book was 46 to 49. Then, as you said, you're reading the 50 to 52 book. But then there's two of the books in the series after that, one which I've just released for 55 to 56. So, it's building up into a bit of a series now. And that's effectively what I'm doing most of the time. I'm just writing those books.
And the new one is called Chasing Shadows? Is it the new one?
Chasing Shadows, that's right. Yeah, it's got a forward by Bryce Zabel.
He was
so the covers behind me. So I've got a couple of friends come up with these amazing covers.
Oh, that's
I just
the cover.
Give them a case and say, yeah, just come up with a case, Dan Olaf, and that's what they do. They come up with these amazing renditions.
Yeah, well, and I know I actually had lunch with Bryce Sable just a little while ago. He's a lovely man, and a great resource for the community.
Yeah, I met him at Roswell last year. I was asked to go and speak at the conference at the end of June, begin July. And Bryce was another one of the speakers. And he was just seemed to be a kind of kindred spirit and somebody who spoke a lot of sense on the subject, who was asking the right questions, didn't sort of fall into the kind of rabbit holes that, exist in this topic. He was just a really, really no-nonsense, very, very sensible and very approachable guy. And it was great to spend some time with them, not just at the speaker's meals, but in the hotel as well, before or after the conferences, just having these real long form conversations about all and sundry. It was brilliant. And as somebody who really enjoyed his Dark Skies TV show back in the 1990s, it was a kind of dream come true just to meet a co-producer of that program. So yeah, it was brilliant.
I know. I wish I could find somewhere that's streaming the series. I know you can stream the pilot movie for it right now, yeah. But I can't find the series anywhere. But if people can find it, it's really worth watching.
I need to see it.
Definitely.
Just about World War II for a minute, because you mentioned German tech. There were some really fascinating portrayals of just what it was like for a pilot to fly over Germany at night, an Allied pilot, and sort of the various pressures and tensions on that pilot. Can you and so just a general fog of war feeling I got about like how it could have affected reporting of UAP. Can you talk about some of those? I guess in some cases, maybe just talk about what a pilot was dealing with and why it was maybe hard to get, or why it was so hard to get research on this subject and how you managed to do that.
So I try to set the context in terms of how the bomber crews were operating, because they provide a lot of the reports on this subject during World War II. And then later the US Army Air Force night fighter crews who were based in France and Belgium and Northern Italy, they experienced the same kind of things. So they're all under the same effect of pressure that you're flying in the dark, you're firing against enemy defenses, so you're being shot at by anti-aircraft guns, but also you're in the glare of searchlights, which then attract the guns as well. But also they have night fighters flying to try and shoot you down. So there's all, you're being attacked in all different ways. There's always that ever-present fear that you're going to be attacked. And anything in the sky that might be a light, something out of the ordinary, is of interest. So you've got maybe six, seven, sometimes more, highly trained observers in an airplane. And basically all they're doing is just looking out of any window, any gun turret, to see what is coming in their direction. Or they're looking out to the side of the airplane, they're looking behind them, they're looking up front, they're looking above, you name it, they're looking elsewhere. RAF aircraft, initially in the war, they weren't fitted with much in the way of guidance systems or bombing aids or electronics. That came a bit later, but then it became an electronic cat and mouse game between them and the Germans. So everybody was, they were inventing stuff to defeat radar or to make radar better or to be able to drop their bombs on target much more effectively. And then there was what they called homing devices. So the enemy night fighters could home in on emissions from RAF bomber, radar systems for dropping bombs or for early warning radar that they had fitted to actually to detect the approach of night fighters. The Germans developed systems which could actually home in on those things that were supposed to keep the bomber crew safe. Now, when it came to the Americans flying in Europe, they had the similar pressures, but they were flying in the daytime. So it was a different sort of scenario in terms of the German fighters, because there were a lot more of them flying, the daytime fighters. They were coming in huge swarms. And if anybody's seen the Masters of the Air documentary that's on Apple at the moment, then
I know, I want to. I hear it's great.
It's not quite a faithful rendition of air attacks, because there's far too many aircraft and they're really grouped together in terms of the German fighters. But it's sort of spot on in terms of the damage that you can inflict to a bomber just by one particular aircraft. So, there was a lot of pressures, a lot of stress. But also stress leads to people seeing things when they may not be there, or reporting the least bit thing that they see and blowing it out of proportion. However, a lot of things were seen as well which just defy explanation. And they did catalogue them. They're in the mission reports, these things that they see. It's not just the Foo Fighters, which is a phenomenon which started at the end of 1944. If you go all the way back to 1940, the summer 1940, in the RAF Bomber Command's intelligence documents, you will see that they started a fairly extensive month-by-month analysis of lights that followed bombers. Now, they at the time, they thought they were German night fighters, but in some cases, they were following these bombers for 250 miles, which is a long way to follow something without opening fire or doing something else. You know, what's the point? So over a period of about 2 years, they tried to work out what these things were. And at the end of the day, they just gave up because they didn't know.
And now in some cases, and I'm sorry to interrupt Graham, and that there's a slight delay, but in some cases they did open fire, correct? Like there was some reports, oh, yeah. And I don't know if it was the RFA pilots, but there was reports of just the bullets just going into these, or explain to what some of those interactions were.
So the story that you're talking about happened in March 1942, and it's a RAF bomber coming back from a raid on Essen in the Ruhr in Germany. And it's a Polish crew on board. It's 301 Squadron. They're based in Lincolnshire in England. And they're coming back from the bombing raid. And over Holland, the tail gunner of this twin-engined aircraft, a Wellington bomber, he then shouts over the intercom, there's a light coming up behind us. And it was just an orange disc, basically. That's what it was reported as. Now, anything like that, anything out of the ordinary, well, it's going to be a German night fighter, or at least that was the feeling back then, that you know anything coming behind a bomber would be something coming to shoot you down. So the pilot radios back and says, look, you know, if it gets close enough, within range, open fire at it, which would be standard procedure anyway. And the gunner did open fire at it, and he's got four machine guns in his tail turret, and he fires at this thing. Every 10th round is a tracer, so it's a phosphorescent bullet, which means you can see where the bullet goes, so that you know that helps with their aiming, and the bullets go into this disc, this red, this orange light, and nothing happens. They don't go out the other side. The disc doesn't blow up. It doesn't fall away in flames. It doesn't try to evade. The bullets just go into it. It then moves around to the wingtip of the aeroplane. It sits off the wingtip of the bomber, and you know it sits there for a bit as the bomber's flying through the sky, and then after a little while. Still, the gun that was firing at it was all the time it was moving around. It then moves around to a point off the nose of the airplane, and the nose gunner is firing at it as well by that point. And it's just, for want of a better expression, it's absorbing the bullets because they're not going anywhere. They're just disappearing into it. And that's not a German airplane, because if that was the case, it would have been riddled full of holes, or it would have caught fire, or it would have exploded, or the pilot would have evaded the bullets. So it then, after a while, the aircraft flying through the sky, maybe 200 miles an hour or so, this thing's keeping station some distance ahead, it then just shoots off at 45 degrees into the heavens and disappears. When they're back on the ground, of course, the crew are talking to the intelligence officers in the debrief afterwards, where that happened every mission, didn't matter what happened. You know, what are the defenses like? Have you dropped your bombs on time? Did you see anything out of the unusual? You know, this kind of stuff. And they mention this. And of course, the initial response is, you know, have you been drinking, old man? You know, kind of thing. You know, are you trying to get off flying? Are you trying to pretend you're mad? All this kind of stigma, which was also prevalent back then. That wasn't a thing that just started in the 1950s with airliner pilots and with military pilots getting this kind of stigma for UFOs. But they were saved effectively by a crew of an aircraft behind them in the bomber formation, which is like a loose string of airplanes. It wasn't really a tight formation like the daytime raids that the Americans did. You're talking about a gaggle of maybe 200, 300 aircraft along a long string, maybe 40, 50 miles long. So you can see how they're well dispersed. But this aircraft behind them in the stream actually said, the pilot said, we saw that thing as well. So, it's one of those stories where there's no official documentation, just the pilot testimony. But other ones do have actually some kind of paperwork with them. There's a story from November of that year, 42, where there was a British bomber flying over northern Italy on its way to bomb an engine factory in Turin. And they come across this 200 to 300 foot long torpedo shaped object, and they see it twice. First time is at an altitude. Second time, it's down in a mountain valley flying along between the mountain peaks. And that's a story, funny enough, which I've delved into the pilot's history, because a lot of these stories, when you see previous published accounts about Foo Fighters and things like that, there wasn't much kind of research around the edges to see, the history of the pilots and the aircraft and the bases and the all this kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing that I do to try and bring a little bit more kind of sort of context to the case as well, rather than just the bare bones that you see often if you see them written about on the internet or in other books. So, yeah. So that's the kind of thing I do.
Mm-hmm. And you keep answering questions before I can get to them.
Sorry, Dave.
No, that's all right. It's really informative. But yeah,
that was a two Ronnie sketch in the UK.
The two Ronnies.
The mastermind, the quiz game for the UK, and it was answering the question before last. That was a specialist subject.
Yeah. But no, because I was going to say, I was curious as to whether or not the stigma, like whether there would be more reporting and more of a paper trail on things during the war, because they would have to consider the possibility of it being an adversary.
Of course, yeah. I mean, everything was written down after a raid. And if you look at the official squadron records and the mission reports, you find them not just for the Americans, but you find them for the British as well. In London, the National Archives have an extensive, sort of collection of each squadron. So whether it's a fighter squadron or a transport squadron or a bomber squadron, anti-submarine squadron, you can read all the day-to-day mission reports. And some of these things do crop up. They're not very detailed, and it was quite patchy. Some of the squadrons had very little information. So you were lucky if you got one kind of paragraph for an entire squadron for an entire raid, whereas other ones you might have a bit more. And then the really good ones, the clerk who would be in charge of writing all this information down, would actually have an individual kind of summary for each aircraft on each raid, for every day in each month. So you get a whole lot of information that you could look through to find these particular these cases of things that we would call UFOs nowadays. Back then, of course, extraterrestrials, UFOs, all that kind of flying saucers, that wasn't a term that they used. It wasn't even on their radar. So none of the kind of analysis from back then suggests this is anything out of the ordinary beyond it's a German secret weapon or something that they haven't, that's been built that they haven't come across yet. So, nothing that we think of today, that just wasn't, what they were sort of considering. And at the end of the day, when they finally got to the end of the war and it was like, well, what were these things? They were just kind of wrote them off as being jet fighters or flak rockets, pretty mundane things. But all these lights and stuff, they were flying around in circles in the aircraft. They were following them. They couldn't be evaded in some respects. And in others, as we've already discussed, they were shot at and didn't fall out of the sky. Well, they're not German airplanes. So,
the bullets didn't proceed through it. Like it wasn't just a light, right? Or some people say plasma or...
Yeah, and your stigma, I mean, you mentioned about stigma there. Another squadron, 43 Squadron, which is a fighter squadron based out in the North Africa in 43, in the spring of that year, their pilots, one by one, because they were flying night intruder missions over German lines, and one by one, their pilots were seeing what they called the thing. That was their name for it back then. And it was effectively what the Americans then later called the Foo Fighters, because these were lights that just followed the airplanes and they would evade them or try to evade the maneuvers, and they couldn't shake them from either their tail or their wingtip. And the stigma was that initially the first pilots who saw it, they were written off as being kind of mad or you're making up stories, all this kind of stuff. And just objects of ridicule on the squadron. I mean, it was banter. It was, you know, it was, some of it was lighthearted, but other times it wasn't. But one by one, the squadron pilots saw it. And obviously, you know, it became really serious then. So it was something they couldn't make a joke of. But yeah, in a lot of the times in the squadrons, if you saw something strange and you reported it, you were the butt of jokes for ages afterwards because, oh, that's the guy who saw that light and it didn't appear, you know, this kind of stuff. So yeah, it was, the stigma started early.
Yeah, but it wasn't an official and institutionalized stigma yet. It wasn't.
It was just that kind of banter that the pilots, British, American, probably German as well, if they saw these as well. It's the kind of camaraderie and the lighthearted, but then not so lighthearted kind of interactions that they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it amazes me that there's because you have this an article in the debrief. We had Alex Dietrich on, and we're getting her account of the Tic Tac, and it just amazes me that sort of iconography of this character of some of these ships goes back to that wasn't just seen in 2004 or can you tell us about what seems like maybe the first official record of the Tic Tac, because I think it's just really cool that these ships or whatever we see, there's one that's seen with these weird traits and they're ridiculed for that, and then you realize, oh wait, it was reported back all these decades ago. So can you just tell us a little bit about what might be the first recorded Tic Tac event?
Well, I mean, Tic Tac, it's a new word or a new phrase for maybe an old object. I mean, if you guys ever read, sort of UFO books from the 60s and 70s, you'll have come across the phrase cigar-shaped object.
Right.
You know, that's a thing that used to always appear in those books. You know, I remember from when I first started reading books in the mid-1970s on this subject. So that was they might as well be Tic Tacs from the shape, how it's described. But then there were torpedo-shaped objects, the one I mentioned before, the one over northern Italy in 1942. So that's although it's a lot bigger, and the Tic Tac that Alex Dietrich came across, I think that was, I'm sure they said that was 57 or 47 feet long, one of the two anyway. So probably maybe, a quarter of the size of the one that was seen over northern Italy. So there's an early sort of case. But I guess if you go back to the airship sightings of the late 1890s, then the shape of those could be construed as a Tic Tac as well, but just by the way things are explained in the language of the time. So the people back there who saw them would think, well, they're airships because people were experimenting with airships, albeit not as sophisticated as the ones that were reported in America at that time. But, there's an early version as well. And of course, there were mystery airships in the first decade of the 1900s as well that were seen over Britain and Europe, etc. So you have early iterations of them there as well. So yeah, you can go way back, and not just World War II. You can go even further back to see, sightings of these things that may or may not be the same object or just slightly different in scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. At some point, they would be referred to as propane tank, flying propane tanks.
Propane tanks, yeah, butane tanks. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and well, I guess they did. Well, they didn't. The mints didn't exist then, which is unfortunate for everyone at the time. They lacked the, they didn't get the good nickname for their UFOs, and they had dreadful breath.
No, they didn't.
They didn't have multiple solutions exactly.
Yeah, but it does seem like every time we think we're experiencing something new in this field, you realize that it's been repeated and just been described differently throughout history.
Yeah, I think that's the importance of historical cases. Some people occasionally say to me, well, why are you concentrating on the old stuff? It's been done to death. Well, actually, it hasn't, because a lot of stuff that I've come up with in some of these books, people won't have read about those before. They might have come across them in a book from years ago, but the way that they were reported in the books that I used to read, the same books I mentioned before, you were lucky if you got a paragraph or a couple of lines about an incident. It was always, I need to move on to the next bit. And the author would be just putting lots of cases in, but very, very little data. And you wouldn't get the kind of the long form, like look at the intelligence documents around the case and all the rest of it. So I felt that was really important to just to basically throw everything that there was about the case itself, all the reporting, all the analysis that I could find, and say, well, look, this is all the information to do with this case. You as a reader, make your mind up as to what's happening here, rather than me just putting a few lines about a case down and then the next one, and then trying to write a narrative to say, this is what I think's happening, or this is what I believe's happening. And actually, then I'll look at it and think, well, actually, no, it's nothing of the sort. You're just making this up. I've read lots of books like that as well. So I just wanted to actually let the reader decide. You know, I give them the tools to do it, but then it's up to them what they come up with at the end of the day.
And it seems like it's a really great sort of way that you're sort of taking call it early history, but it's call it the recent early history of UFOs. and you're taking slices of it and sort of taking a deeper look at all these slices of different points in history. Yeah. Which is a great counter to the people who constantly are saying, well, there's never been any evidence. There's zero evidence. Whereas there's been waves of evidence going back to to the war time, to the war years, and just waves and waves of it and waves of people not paying attention.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a difference obviously though between evidence and proof. So that's, you know, we still haven't got to the proof stage. I mean, some people say we have, you know, I'm still waiting for it myself, but evidence, yeah, there's a lot of evidence which suggests that there's definitely something happening. It's been going on for a long, long time. A lot of people have seen it, as you say. There's a lot of credible people have seen it as well, which you can't ignore. And in a lot of the analysis just doesn't stack up, especially when you go back to the official American programs of the 40s and 50s and the kind of things they were trying to tell us that these things were, when the information they were given, you know, you couldn't reach that kind of, you know, a conclusion from the information that they had. It was just almost a public relations exercise to say, look, we're looking at the problem, but actually there's nothing to see here, guys, you know, move along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a public misconception. People don't really understand the distinction between evidence and proof, or they dismiss evidence as being somehow not as important as proof. Like, for example, I would use the example that, you know, we have a tremendous amount of evidence that quantum theory is correct, but we have no proof that quantum mechanics is correct. But we have a lot of evidence that, you know, we can make predictions and we can build technologies based on it. But we don't really know fundamentally how it works or if it is correct at all. But
you don't have half of Twitter, you don't have the media, you don't have everybody and his dog basically lining up to have a go at these scientists and saying, you're wrong, you know, there's no proof, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, and making jokes about them. There's none of that in that field, or very little.
Yeah. I think it's starting to happen in the string theory people. Yeah.
Right, is it? Oh, dear.
they're getting a few attacks these days.
Right. But it's nothing on the scale that we're getting, though, is it?
So, no, not at all. Know. No, and it's the lack of, you know, and the response to, you know, like people who disagree with string theory, the response is to put forward other theories, and people who want to take issue with string theory actually look at the data and study the results. But the people who want to take issue with the UFO phenomena just say, I will not look at anything until there is proof, which is an odd way for a scientist to approach any subject.
And I think it's a lack of, and when you look at a lot of the media kind of takes on it, they will, especially news anchors, they just make a joke of it because you can tell there's a lack of understanding or a lack of knowledge. And I think it's actually a lack of knowledge because they might have a kind of superficial idea about what's happening. And no doubt whoever's, you know, the research people behind the scenes will have given them something to read to introduce the item. But they won't have that much knowledge, in all truth, about the history and the rich rich history of ufology as well, and of sightings, you know, throughout the decades and the centuries even. So until you have that, you can't really, I guess, you know, have a really informed opinion on it. You have to have some kind of grounding in the subject. You have to at least touch on the major cases and some of the minor ones as well. But you have to have an idea of what's happened from the start to finish. You can't just cherry pick bits and go, you know, oh, I've seen that bit and therefore I don't believe it. Or, as a lot of people have done, they've come into the subject since 2017, since the release of those three videos by Tom DeLonge and his mates to the Stars Academy. And a lot of people have come in since then, and they've only looked at the modern day stuff, you know, as in, you know, the last 6 years. And they don't know what's happened beforehand. And I would hope at some stage they do have the time and the inclination to look at the, you know, the earlier cases. Because, as you say, things that have happened years ago are happening now. There's parallels, and, you know, history tends to go in cycles. There's nothing new under the sun.
I also, you know, but at the same time, as a historian on this topic and having done this level of research in depth, trying to separate fact from fiction, trying to separate myth from, you know, as much reality as we can ascertain in this case, yeah. You know, it's important to confront, you know, even recent, you know, developments in this story and in this topic. I'm curious, you know, where you stand on the, you know, on the issue of like debris and do we not have, or how much, I guess, evidence do you feel exists? We know we don't have proof. But I guess in terms of the way you weigh these kind of, you know, you take accounts from pilots, like you're really trying to kind of gauge, there's been a lot of, everybody's kind of supposed to jump in lockstep and take everything David Grush says, and I have no reason to doubt him. But I'm also like, I also think it's important to look at everything with as much scrutiny as possible. Where do you feel we are in terms of the evidence on that the government has debris or stuff from crash sites?
There's a lot of stories over the decades. So from Roswell and Ashley.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Probably before there's been things allegedly, you know, falling on the earth. So whether they are crashes as, you know, because of mechanical failure or whatever, or pilot error, if you can call them pilots, or some people nowadays say that there might be gifts to us. And I've never really understood that one, but there you go. Whichever way you look at it, there's lots of stories over the years as to things that have crashed here, there, and everywhere, not just in the States, but other countries around the world. So if that's true, then there must be a pile of debris, if not intact craft, sitting in various places around the world. Now, that's evidence of the sort because they're stories. But then when you get to documentation and you get to actual proof, it, you know, you just don't have that yet. And I guess Roswell's the most famous one. And like a lot of people, probably you guys, I've read the books about it. I've even been there as well. And I'm still no further forward at the end of the day as to how true that story is. It's one of those ones that obviously I'd love to be true. But unfortunately, starting off at a position when I first started reading about it back in, was it 1980, I think, when the Roswell incident came out, And then the successive books and the people who did the research into it, like Kevin Randall, afterwards, it got to a point where it was a peak where you thought, this is definitely coming together. And yet some of the witnesses turned out to be fraudulent. They were people who were inserting themselves into the story. Mm. So they, for whatever reason, they felt they could have a little bit of fame or attention themselves. So that kind of muddies the waters a bit. And it only takes a few people, and it was literally just a few people, to actually cast doubt. And certainly other people who may have a less... a much less kind of belief of Roswell, that's going to make them think, well, is the rest of the story, you know, kind of kosher as well? And I still think there's something to it, but I'm not entirely sure how much, you know, what degree there is of truth behind it all. It's one of those things that the more you read, the more you hear, the less you understand. And I'm at the point now where, a bit like the Bob Lazar story, that I just don't know. And I think that's, you know, where I am now. And Bob Lazar especially, because he's one of these people that when he came out, he was in the right place, the right time, had this amazing story. And I remember, you know, first hearing about it and just going, what? You know, yes. And like a lot of people, you know, this kind of being incredulous when you heard about this story about him being at S4 in Area 51. And yet over the years, people... you know, for whatever reason, have chipped away at his story. They've obviously, he's not perfect. He's not a perfect human being. You could argue that he's the ideal patsy for somebody who might be involved in a project like that because of his past, of his history, and all this baggage he has around him. Now, that doesn't mean to say he wasn't involved with a program like that, but also he's the perfect person to deflect attention away from. You know, because, well, how can he be part of a project like that when he's got all this other stuff going on? And the fact that he doesn't have a record at MIT, apart from, you know, listing that he apparently attended some lectures or what have you, but he wasn't on any of the proper programs there. Right. And a whole lot of other stuff going on as well, which cast doubt on his entire story. And it comes down at the end of the day as to what you want to believe, because there's... It's not riddled with holes, but there's a few things that don't quite add up. And the same's with Roswell. But unfortunately, that's the same with a lot of stories in ufology. And it's just the way it is. And you have to kind of navigate your way around those and try and get as much truth or as much evidence as you can. And then, you know, the holes will sort of fall away on their own. But a lot of them don't, because they're persistent little buggers and they stay in the story. And it just still makes you think, well, okay, we've got everything here. This is great in terms of pushing the UFO narrative. But this other bit, I'm not sure about that. And I'm afraid there are just too many stories like that still where, you know, we want them to be true, and some of us desperately want them to be true. And the people who desperately want them to be true are blinded to the other things, which are maybe, you know, a little bit suspect. So I just I think you should just be as objective as you can, be as realistic as you can, and, you know, come to the point of, well, not everything about a case can be perfect. And unfortunately, you might get to a really good case initially, but actually it turns out to be a crock of, well, you know, SH1T. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'm curious, who was when you say some people involved with the Roswell story were discredited, would it be any of the major
players?
There's
a guy who came out with a diary. And that turned out to be false. Mm-hmm. There's a guy called Kaufman, I believe. He was a bit suspect. And then there's Glenn Dennis, the mortician. He sent investigators out on a wild goose chase with the name of the nurse that allegedly told him about the child-sized coffins and the bodies and that kind of thing. So, you know, Kevin Randall and his colleagues were looking for this nurse because he'd given them a false name. And then, you know, didn't expect them to find them. And there was all this kind of cock and bull story about, oh, why are you giving you a false name for, and all this sort of thing. And I think when people start doing stuff like that, it just makes you wonder as to how kind of truthful they are in everything else they're saying. Because if you're going to, you know, start to spin things out a bit or sort of wrap yourself in knots, just trying to like tell one part of the story, because you might think it sounds good, or because you maybe want to deflect attention away from something else. then, you know, what else are you trying to hide? So it just sort of takes a shine off somebody as a witness who originally sounded like a really good witness, you know, turns up with a, he gets a phone call, come along, you know, what size coffins do you have? Can you come to the, you know, can you come to the base? Yeah, all this kind of stuff. And then he comes up with a story that he meets a nurse and yada, yada, yada. And it just sort of, it just takes the edge off the story a bit for me, I'm afraid.
I think it's important to, you know, look at it this way, you know, because it's there's no question in my mind, because when you kind of go like macro and you look at the entire totality of the history of UFOs, it's to me kind of beyond, and it must be to you, Graham, having done all this. I mean, people have seen, it's like there is something in the skies people have seen for decades and decades, centuries perhaps. So, and yet, you know, you kind of narrow down on some of these really sort of like choicest bits, and they, and yes, there's sometimes like it kind of crumbles under the hot spotlight. And that's what's so maddening and seductive about this topic is, you know, I can hear personal abduction stories and be just riveted and convinced of the authenticity of the person and their story. And yet there are these, you know, the big story being written right now, almost daily, weekly, like new, you know, this and the organization and people sort of coming to the topic. I just think it is important to, you know, to be, you know, to scrutinize what we're hearing and judge.
I don't think there should be any sacred cows at all, you know, in ufology. There shouldn't be any kind of case where you can't criticize it. You can't. If you discover something that's wrong with it, you shouldn't tell anybody. You know, you have to, because everybody has to be honest about, you know, what they're looking at, and because otherwise, you know, there's no way forward, and we're not going to make any progress. And in the UFOs before Roswell, there's one. It's not a celebrated case, but it's one that's appeared in a few books. And I looked at it, and I looked into the background of it, and I looked into the background of the pilot and where he said he was, which unit he flew with, and all this sort of thing. And I found he wasn't even with a squadron at the time. Of the so-called incident. So it's a kind of, it leaves you thinking, you're sort of asking yourself, well, how was he there? You know, how does he know that information? How can he say he was flying with that squadron at the time and he saw this object when clearly he wasn't, because the records state that he moved on. So, and there's a few other things that I sort of draw attention to, because I think it's helpful. You know, I'm not trying to debunk cases. I mean, that's not my object, but I'm just trying to tell the truth about things, because I think as a historian, that's obviously really important. But then the next thing is the myths that build up, because the internet's a great place to propagate myths. You know, at one time you had to read them in books, and it was a, you know, very limited readership. Whereas now, you know, anybody around the world can read about things that are, you know, sort of put up as a purported reason for the Foo Fighters, let's say. Whereas, you know, when you look into them, they're nothing of the sort. So, you know, those things have to be looked at as well and explained.
Speaking to that, just you mentioned German tech as something that was kind of on the other side. It was sort of, that was a way to kind of dismiss either the Foo Fighters or ships that were things that people were seeing in Time the World. Can you talk about what that mythology is of this sort of German technology, or they were making their own specialized futuristic ships?
A lot of that built up after the war. So there's no records during the war that anybody's been able to sort of find that have borne any kind of scrutiny of the Germans building flying discs, for instance, because there's a huge Nazi flying saucer myth out there. And it's quite, it's lasted a long time. I mean, I first remember reading about it back in 1982. So that you know, that dates me. In a book about airplanes, about German jet airplanes, would you believe? It wasn't anything to do about UFOs, but that's where it cropped up. And there'd been books before that, even from the 1950s, that had sort of touched on this. But it all goes back to newspaper reports in Germany in the 1950s, in about 1950, 1951, 1952, where people were coming out of the woodwork saying, I worked on German flying disc programs during the war. You know, I'm looking for the Americans to take me to America to work on America, on projects of aircraft across there. And what, in one particular case, he reckoned he was a test pilot for Henkel, one of the big German aircraft manufacturers during the war. Well, there's no record of him ever being a test pilot for them. In reality, after the war, he reckoned, well, he said he was an engineer, but really he was delivering newspapers for the US Army in the occupied part of Germany. So, you know, that's what, if he was some kind of high-performing engineer who had come up with some radical disc-shaped aeroplane with some amazing kind of propulsion system, which could, you know, obviously no wings, no propellers, no jets, presumably, then what was he doing delivering newspapers for the army? Why wasn't he, or why hadn't he been taken up by Paperclip, which was the brain drain of German rocket and aeronautical scientists and designers and engineers? Why wasn't he taken over to America in 1945 and 1946? You know, why was he still languishing in Bremen in 1951 and then writing things to the newspaper saying, you know, people have been approaching me about interesting my ideas. Well, yeah, of course, if you're going to tell this amazing story, people are going to want to know, but they're going to find out very quickly that you're telling a whole load of, you know, just porky pies kind of thing. So it didn't go anywhere. But there was other people at the same time did.
Yeah. The British and the Americans put a lot of resources into intelligence gathering during the war.
They did.
And shortly after
they
it.
Did.
Yeah, so they knew a great deal about who, what scientists were doing what within Germany.
Early 1944, yeah.
Yeah, and a pretty good bit of evidence that the Germans hadn't mastered, you know, anti-gravity and UFO technology. They lost.
They lost, yeah, that's a big one, isn't it?
I think that had they really had this tech, we might be a little careful about what we say about Hitler right now.
we'll be conducting this conversation in German anyway.
Oh yes, anyway, yes. So. And very respectfully of in memory of the Führer.
I mean, going back to early 1944, the Americans and the British actually had teams of people who were assigned to see what they were going to look at after the end of the war. They were, you know, they were compiling lists of factories, of research facilities, and they knew what they were doing at these places. So it wasn't as if there was very much that was in the way of secret. And then, of course, as the war ended, you know, they had jeep loads and truckloads of people going around Germany, descending all these places and just pulling them apart, taking away anything that was of value, questioning everybody who they could grab a hold of. And there's this, you know, report after report that you can actually read if you know where to look for these things. They're called BIOS and SIOS reports for anybody who's interested. It's the British Intelligence Objective Subcommittee, or the Combined Intelligence Operation Objective Subcommittee for the American side. And there's thousands of reports, not just thousands of pages, but thousands of reports. And they go from everything from dentistry to metallurgy to, you know, aeronautics to rocket research to everything the Germans were working on. So if there'd been anything that had been, you know, kind of specialized that might have explained the Foo Fighters, or they were working on disc-shaped airplanes, it would have been there, but it's not. That's the thing.
I know there's all those terrible TV documentaries that talk about the Nazis and UFOs. There's always that thing that, where they'll say that the V2 bomb were achieved through alien intervention and alien guidance, and they were leading the German scientists to create this technology. And I was that seems a little odd, since rocketry is kind of something that the Chinese worked out the basics of it a very, very long time ago. And I'm not sure why aliens would come down and start explaining how rockets work.
Yeah, I used to. There was a VHS, and that dates me again. Documentary. It was UFO Secrets of the Third Reich. I think it was from the early 1990s, and it was just a weird and wonderful look at this subject. And at one point, they said, you know, about the Germans having contact with people from Aldebaran, and that's when I went, right, that's going to be switched off right now, because it was just wasn't worth bothering any further with, because they jumped the shark, as they say.
Yeah.
So.
I'm old enough that most of my video library is on wax cylinders. So,
it's true. Stone tablet.
Yeah.
I've seen it. And speaking of, I guess, you know, mythology and stories and what are we, and again, I kind of rely on your you know, research and expertise on this. You know, we heard a lot about this ship that was recovered in 1933. David Grush brought it up in front of Congress or the committee. What kind of evidence do we have for that? Or do we have evidence for that? I mean, we certainly don't have proof. We don't have the ship, but mm-hmm. where do you fall on that
story? Was the story circulating before Grush? Yeah.
It was, yeah. There's it's been around for a little while, so a couple of decades at least. And yes, there is evidence of a sort in terms of sort of telegrams, letters that are on official kind of telegram paper or note paper from back then. But that unfortunately doesn't necessarily mean that they were from the time. And they have been sort of independently looked at by an expert, but I think they need more kind of independent experts, because it depends, you know, you can have an expert, it could be somebody who you may get along to actually tell your side of the story. It should be somebody else. I think it should be maybe best of three, if you like, because there's a few things in that it didn't quite add up for me, but that doesn't mean to say it didn't happen. And it's one of those where at the moment it's a lovely story, but you need more evidence, and we need a bit more around it as to where, you know, where it ended up. They need a bit of a paper trail. And for the story to say, well, look, the Americans got it, because it fluctuates as to were the OSS involved? That's a pre-runner to the CIA. Did they parachute people in to grab it? That's another story I've heard. You just hear also so many things around it that it doesn't quite fit in with everything else that's happening. So you know, it's quite an outlier in some respects, this particular story. And there are other stories of things being retrieved in the 30s. There's a story about something coming down in Poland as well that the Germans might have got a hold of, but you see these stories don't have legs. They don't. There's not much more to them. So at the moment, all we know is that this thing was supposed to either crashed or landed. It was somehow the Italians got it. They, for whatever reason, they didn't look at it too much because they didn't understand it, and it was put in an aircraft hangar. The Sion Marchetti aircraft company at their place up in northern Italy, and it was just left there by all accounts. The bit that doesn't add up to me is that the Germans and the Italians were allies, and they were exchanging information on aeroplanes and technology. So why didn't the Germans get involved? Why wasn't it spirited to Germany? The south of Italy, they surrendered in 43. But the North still carried on under the Fascist Republic, and that's where this thing was, allegedly. So why didn't the Germans grab it? Because they must have you would have thought they would have found out about it at some stage. So that's not quite sort of, you know, I just wonder about that. And then we've got the bits about alternatively either the OSS going to grab it or the US Army picking it up. But then there's no stories about, you know, the people who did that, because you would think that would be a big thing and that might have come out somewhere. So I think there's a lot more work needs to be done on this story to actually make it sort of hold up a bit more than it has already. But that's not to say it's not true, because, you know, tomorrow there could be a whole load of information that comes out and goes, you know, oh, right, that's definitely something that's happened. So you can never write something off. It's just another mm-hmm. one of those where you just have there's just enough doubt in my mind to think, well, I don't know. And I think that's maybe the best thing I can say is I simply don't know. And yeah. My only kind of fear is that it's not something that David Grush was actually involved with, and that, you know, he was actually actively investigating or had information, kind of, you know, documentation pushed under his nose to say, look, you review this, David. I don't know if you've ever read Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point.
No.
He talks about the last thing he talks about is the Die Glocke, the bell, you know, that supposed anti-gravity project that the Germans were supposed to be working on at the end of the war. But earlier in the book, one of his sources, one of his aviation sources, comes up with this thing called the legend, inverted commas, and it's supposed to be the narrative of what happened from the sort of 30s through the 40s, 50s, 60s, etc., in terms of UFOs. And I just hope it's nothing to do with this, because that seemed a bit exaggerated for me, that the way it was portrayed by by Nick Cook's source. And it also meant, you know, it might be all wrapped up with German flying saucers and all the rest of it. And I just hope it's not kind of a made-up thing in the background that, you know, people sort of latch onto, and somehow information from it ends up in the intelligence community. And they, you know, because they don't have much to work with, it's just one of those things that gets perpetuated. I really hope it's not something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I would like to think that people like that wouldn't get involved with that kind of stuff, but you never can tell. But that's not to say that, you know, it could well be true.
And there's also the interesting angle of the Pope facilitating the transfer of the material, if that's that the Vatican was directly involved in moving the material from Italian provenance to American, which would be interesting.
It's interesting, but it's one of those stories where, you know, it's almost, well, what's the German thing that used to have, like, you know, you hide a lie between two truths, don't you? And I don't know. At the end of the day, Dave, Tom, I'm not sure about it. You know, I can't I can't say it's true. I can't say it's false. There's just a few things in it that just don't add up for me in the overall context of the time and the place and the people who possibly were involved with it. Until we get more information, I think that's how I would leave it.
Yeah, and I think it's critical that we all are involved in this topic in one way or another, kind of all the time. Graham, you've done so much, you know, a lot more research. We're having conversations with people, you know, and it's just important to kind of look up above the trees every once in a while and just be like, okay, well, what has been sort of more verified? What is a little loose? What is some, you know? And it's like you can just continue to kind of get things. It can become a little bit of an echo chamber. And I think it's really important for people that have, you know, deeply studied this topic to be able to, you know, engage with, you know, as much reality as we can on this. And because it's an incredibly fascinating topic, it is the story of the millennia, and it has to, but it also is so fraught with, you know, voices and stories and myth and because of its elusive nature, it's just it's so important.
Sometimes you have to prune a tree to keep it healthy, and I think the work you're doing is a lot of it is, you know, pruning the things that are falsifiable, so that people can focus on and what is still remains a mystery.
I think people, you know, I think it's right for people to say, look, I don't know at the end of the day. You don't have to come down on one side or the other. You can just take a middle ground. And there's always going to be cases where they just don't go anywhere, but there's other ones which will get extra information as the years go on, because people do dig up things. So you just basically, you know, people just wait, have to be patient. And if there's not enough information there to lead you to a conclusion, then it's all right to say, well, at the moment, I'm not sure, but I'm happy to wait for further developments. You know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. My kind of position with a lot of what's mentioned nowadays. It's just, I think I'm old enough and maybe not wise enough, but, you know, sort of mature enough to think, I'm happy to wait. I'm not going to come down on one side or the other. I'm not that, you know, sort of certain, you know, because nothing's certain in ufology. If it's one thing I've ever learned here, that nothing that you read, you should take at face value.
Mm-hmm. And it also, I think it's important for people to remember too, that a disreputable or a dishonest source doesn't negate another source. It's not like you go, you know, if there's one dishonest bit of testimony or one dishonest bit of research, that it must all be dishonest. We're in the entertainment business, and whenever a very famous person dies, there are tons of people who try to attach themselves to that person and tell stories that are clearly not true. But then the fact still remains that Robin Williams existed. It doesn't cancel everything, which I don't think people need to be that sensitive about, about, you know, being critical of some of the stories and some of the legends.
And I think I would love to, we're going to also let you get some sleep, Graham, at some point, you know, but
yeah,
I am curious with all of, you know, you've got this great So you've got a great set of volume of books that cover, you know, this period from like 1940 now to almost to 1955 in terms of these.
1956 is up to
1956.
Now,
yeah. Is there a favorite or two that you weren't aware of before you jumped into this research in depth? Did you find anything that you found that it sort of stands out as a favorite story or sighting that you can tell us about?
Perhaps something from the new book, Chasing Shadows, which people should buy.
I'll leave everything in Chasing Shadows for the reader just to go.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, the book I'm still probably the happiest with is Dawn of the Flying Saucers. And that's the one that tells the story of just before Kenneth Arnold's sighting. So actually 1946 with a couple of Swedish sightings and then a few just before Kenneth Arnold. But then it also tells the story of Project Sign, Project Grudge as well. So that's the early attempts to try and make sense of it all. And actually a few things that happened before Project Sign as well, just to weave those in with a narrative of the aerial incidents. And I guess one that I had actually come across, but I wasn't really aware of too much detail back in the day, was George Gorman's for want of a better word, call it a dogfight. So we're getting back to this kind of thing with a Tic Tac, chasing UFOs round and round in circles. And he was flying an F-51 Mustang at Fargo in North Dakota. And he was coming into land with three other aircraft on a nighttime training flight. And he still has fuel, so he stays up in the circuit. So he has fuel to burn, so he's going to fly around a bit more and get some night flying practice in. And as he's looking down at the lights of the town below him or the city below him, he sees this light flying really quickly. And it's not an aeroplane because you can see another airplane nearby that's coming into land. So he radios the tower and says, I'm going to break off this training flight I'm on. I'm going to go and investigate this light that's flying. So he follows it, and then it basically makes head-on passes at him. So it flies right at him. And the first time it flies right at him, he chickens out basically because he thinks it's going to hit him. Because it's coming straight at his nose. So he dives out the way and it flies over the top of him. Then the second time it does the head-on pass, he then holds his ground and he stays where he is, and it just shoots straight over the top of the aeroplane. And he then tries to follow it, so he puts the aircraft up into a climb, but he runs out of power because it's going much quicker than he is, and it can sustain this rate of climb, where he's in a propeller-driven aeroplane, it's only got a limited amount of power when it's going straight upwards, and it gets to the point where it gets in what they call an engine stall, which means the aircraft can't deliver enough power to keep it flying upwards. It just falls away. So he manages to recover from the spin, but then there's a third attempt with this thing, this light to try and, you know, sort of have a go at him, if you like. It makes a real close pass, and then it just disappears. He gets back on the ground, and the analysis after this event is that he was chasing nothing more than a weather balloon. That's what the official story was. So it's absolutely crazy. So it's just one of those stories. And there were other stories like that at the time where there were strange objects in the vicinity of airfields. And pilots either seeing them or being asked to look at them or just seeing them again and again and not knowing what they were and then being written off as mundane items. In either there were weather balloons. In one case next to the border, I think it was this one, that was an errant Royal Canadian Air Force aircraft which had decided to come over the border and just beat up the circuit at the airfield, you know, sort of thing, which that wouldn't happen. Yeah, it was an international incident.
Especially not from Canadians. I just have to say.
Well, yeah, you're more reserved. You're not going to do that, are you?
No, we're not hot dogs. We're not hot doggers, Canadians.
Very polite.
Yeah.
So, things were written off in weird and wonderful ways back then.
But it does often seem like sometimes it seems like the best evidence for the existence of UAP is the debunking, is the official explanations. I mean, the absurdity of some of the explanations sometimes feels like it's the strongest evidence for this being a serious and real issue.
And it did with Blue Book, because Blue Book was the one that basically made it into an art form, if you like. So it got to the point where, in about the time frame when I'm talking about in Chasing Shadows, is that one, the person who was in charge of it at that time, anything that appeared as a balloon in the reporting or the analysis, even if it was a case of, oh, there was a balloon launched 3 hours afterwards, that was almost enough for him to go, it was a balloon. And then basically say, right, that case is solved, because he was booking for a promotion. He was booking for a transfer away from Blue Book. That was just a stepping stone to something, you know, bigger and better for him. So the more he could say to his superiors, you know, I've sold all these cases, all these cases have been, you know, sort of, you know, worked out on my watch, then that was better for him. He wasn't bothered about whether it was true or not, or whether it was a proper explanation or not. As long as it was stamped solved, that was enough for him. Yeah. So, and you had
when you say
like
him,
that,
can you
just placeholders?
When you say him, you're talking about the officer in charge of Blue Book, or
officer in charge at that time. Yeah, it was called Gregory. Yeah, he was one of those. So there was a few as well.
Yeah, Quintanilla.
Yeah, and they were only short term as well.
Yeah,
they didn't last long.
And again, eventually, I guess it was Hynek was put in a position where he galled himself into becoming an advocate for
disclosure. And we all know the words, swamp gas.
Yeah. Yes, his breaking point.
And I think
it's always swamp gas.
Even he obviously came to realize that it just wasn't on. And I think that was probably the beginning of the end for him. And obviously he wrote, you know, best-selling books in the early 1970s, which effectively turned his previous position on his head, and he became an advocate, you know, for more information and for getting to the bottom of it. Whereas he was basically coming up with everything under the sun to try and dismiss it, based on you know, almost instructions from above saying, this is what you're going to do. You have to debunk these at any costs. I wouldn't have liked to be put in that position myself. And I think I would have just walked away, but for whatever reason, you know, he stayed for some time, but then had to leave because it was just untenable.
Well, for all those, for the fact that in maybe some of our favorite stories, there are some holes that can be poked, it does not dismiss the fact that there is just so much history of lying, of the government lying about what has been happening out there. Just decades of lies and structured lying and programs designed to lie about it. So, yes, the mystery indeed persists, but let us again recommend, I'm reading UFOs Before Roswell about the European Foo Fighters. That covers 1940, 1945. There's several books now by
Dawn of the Flying Saucer.
Graham Rendell, Dawn of the Flying Saucers. Mm-hmm. There's the new one out is called
Chasing Shadows.
It's just a very readable, engaging, suspenseful collection of just extremely well-researched, you know, stories of engagements and sightings through pilots and military people just fascinating. And we really are grateful for you staying up to talk with us and enduring all of our, you know, Falcors and lightings and who we love. It was really great to meet you and speak with you about this, and we hope to do it again sometime.
Guys. I follow you on whatever Twitter is and Instagram, and always really enjoy your posts. So we finally gotten rid of the delay, so I think it's a good time to probably end this.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, Graham.
Thank you so
much. You're welcome.
Great
Thanks
to meet
very
you.
Much. Yeah. Cheers. Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.